Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, for our recipes, culinary ideas from around the world, or our latest cookbooks. Now, here's this week's show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Stephen Satterfield is the founder of Whetstone, a magazine that digs deep into the anthropology of food, far from the world of celebrity chefs.
Food is a universal language. It's such a powerful medium, and it's such a powerful means of connecting with other human beings.
Before we hear from Satterfield, I chat with food writer and journalist Diana Henry, author of How to Eat a Peach, which offers a collection of seasonal menus. Diana, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you. You are ubiquitous.
I mean, sadly.
Well, yeah, you are in my brain. You're in my head. You're here. 10 cookbooks. You've been around a long time. You do a great job of simple cooking. So let's talk about when you started out. What was cooking like when you started out?
When I moved to London in about 1986, and I was an obsessive cook, we were in the middle of Nouvelle Cuisine here. So everybody was using hexagonal plates and buying veal bones and roasting them and reducing the stock down. And into the middle of that actually came Alice Waters, round about that time is when I discovered her. But things have changed a lot since those days.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. You also said, I think you had a great quote. You said, I couldn't stir a risotto for 25 minutes with a baby on my hip. So
no. So
life took over and you decided that, I mean, I guess it's true. Cooking around the world historically fits the lifestyles of the people. And most of the time it's pretty simple, right?
Yeah. I think now I still cook at the weekend as something I love and I put a lot of time into it. But from Monday to Thursday, I am, and I'm sometimes embarrassed to admit this because I'm a food writer, but it's about getting something on the table pretty quickly and with minimum of effort because I've got kids and I've got a full-time job. But that's where a lot of the people I know cook, men and women. So I do a lot of that kind of cooking.
You used to keep a book of menus, right, when you were young?
Yeah, I started that when I was about 16. I went my first trip abroad and I didn't leave Northern Ireland until I was 15 and then I went on my own. So that's part of the urge to think about flavour, I think, is from growing up in Northern Ireland where the food was very good, but it was very basic. And the only way I could travel was by cooking and reading. So then I went to France on an exchange trip when I was 15 years old. I'd never been in a plane before or out of Ireland. And when I was there, I just thought it was the most civilized place in the world. The way they could spend, you know, an evening or from lunch till the middle of the afternoon just having this one meal. And I stayed with a very, very ordinary family. They weren't grand at all. But every meal started with crudités variées, and then there might just have been a pork chop or roast chicken. And then there was a green salad, which was one of the most important things I think I left with, this notion of a green salad made with a proper whole lettuce and just one leaf and a good vinaigrette. And then there might just have been fresh fruit for pudding or a fromage frais or something. But I just thought, look at what they do with something that people have to do three times a day. They take care of it, they honour it, and they take it for granted as well in a certain way, which is good because they didn't make a big fuss about it. It's just that food was important in a good way.
No, that's well said. I think that's absolutely right. It was so ingrained in the culture, they didn't have to talk
about it. Oh, totally.
Right. No. I mean, it's sort of weird when people constantly talk about the food more than they eat it.
London's very bad for that. I mean, some days I just think, give me a boiled egg and a half a grapefruit and then a gin and tonic because really, I don't want to think about trends. I don't want to think about what they're doing in kind of like the East End of London.
So putting aside the hard-boiled egg and the gin and tonic, which sounds perfectly reasonable to me, let's talk about some other food items. You mentioned a salad dressing, a vinaigrette. You know, I grew up with 3 parts oil to 1 part vinegar and made lousy vinaigrettes for 20 years and realized that that's just a small part of the possibilities. If you're going to throw together vinaigrette, what's important to you?
You got to taste it the whole time because your vinegar will be different. Whatever acid you use, in fact, it will vary. And also even the age of your vinegar will make it taste different. So you start with that, and I start with a small amount, and you decide whether you're going to add the Dijon or not, salt and pepper, and then you add the oil gradually, whisking it in. But the thing to do is, I mean, you can have a kind of ratio in your head that's a kind of like ballpark, but I never use it. I just start with a tablespoon of vinegar and then I add, and you have to just taste as you're going along, and then you have to keep adjusting it and then adjust it finally at the end. And I never use Tuscan olive oil. It's too grassy and it's too bitter.
You like toast. Toast is like rice. It's one of those basic ingredients. You can do a lot of stuff with it. So you have leftover bread. You can make croutons, but what do you do with toast?
Well, I think toast is kind of like a plate. And if you're using good bread, if you're using good sourdough, then you have a plate at least that's got some flavor in it. But then I think you can put almost anything on it after that, but you should keep it simple. My basic thing is toast and cheese and a green salad. And then, you know, you've got to work up from there to think of more interesting things to put on it. But I don't think it's a bad fallback at all, as long as your bread is good.
Okay, this is great. On Milk Street Radio, Diana Henry said, toast and cheese in a salad. I love it. Okay, good. You're real. You're not.
I am. You have no idea how real.
You're a real cook. So it's Diana Henry's household. It's 5 p.m. You have a chicken in the fridge. Now what?
Oh, well, I did have last night, actually. Or no, the night before. That's what my son finished his exam, so we had chicken as a treat. I cooked a chicken, high temperature, and all I do is put some oil on the outside, salt and pepper, maybe a lemon inside that I've bashed a bit, and then stuck prongs of a fork in so that the juices of that come out. And I cook that for an hour. And I don't baste it. I don't do anything with it. I keep the legs to the back. So the legs are pointed towards the back of the oven because it's a bit hotter there. And I don't do it in a dish that's much too big for it, because then the juices they'll come off and they'll just kind of burn or just disappear completely. And I did a salsa verde with it because I just happened to have, with not all the herbs that you should have, because I had two of them. But that again was looking partly at what was in my fridge and thinking, okay, that basil should be used now, really. And that was it. That's what we had. And I had put little tiny potatoes in olive oil and rosemary, and those went in for the last 45 minutes of the chicken cooking.
Pasta. I know you have reservations about pasta, but something that cooks in about the same amount of time they would take to cook the pasta.
Oh, this is what I always tell people to do. I say that they're better to have this than a ready meal. Everybody who says, I'm so tired. spaghetti into the pot, and then you chop garlic, you chop parsley, you finely grate the zest of a lemon, and you get dried chili flakes. And then you drain the pasta, and you have already warmed some olive oil and sautéed the garlic a bit. So you basically toss all that together. Do you know, that is one of my favorite suppers.
So your latest book, How to Eat a Peach, that was based upon a very simple dessert you had in Italy, I believe, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I was in my early 20s and I'd never been to Italy before. And we stayed in a little apartment in Siena, and I cooked Marcella Hazan every day. And then on the last night, we went out for dinner, and it was a very simple restaurant. It wasn't fancy at all. But at the next table, they didn't have what British people might regard as a pudding. They had a bowl of peaches and a bottle of very cold Moscato. And they have the peaches, and they sliced them, and they dropped them in their wine glasses. And then they topped it up with the wine. And then they let them macerate and gesticulated and chatted for 15 minutes. Hmm. And then they ate the peaches with little forks, and then they drank the wine. And I thought this just looked heavenly, simple. And it said quite a lot to me about food, really, when you should know when not to cook it, when to leave it alone, when just to put things together, and that you appreciate those elements without even applying heat to them at all.
So you have menus, usually three courses, I believe. I'm terrible at menus. I hate menus. I love cooking.
Why?
Well, because I'm not good at it. You obviously are. So how do you think about it? What is a menu for you?
First of all, I think you can start wherever you want. You don't have to do the main course first, which is what most people do. I think you can, every year, you know, the things I want to cook, soon it'll be apricot tart. They're just starting to come in. And then you can work backwards from there. You don't have to do it in the most obvious way. I like to think of what goes with what in terms of flavour and texture, and also what's doable without getting too exhausted. Right. And I like the idea that they kind of take you somewhere. So quite often they're based on a place, you know, in Menubook there's a New York menu and there's menu set in Brittany and stuff like that. But I just think that's what food is for me. It's about going to other places. But also I just like the way they can meander around. I mean that tart I just mentioned, the apricot tart, there's a menu in the book which is Summer Begins with Apricot Tart, but before it there's just a chicken cooked with lemons inside. And then before that, there is a salad of raw sea bass with radishes and nasturtium flowers and leaves, which are quite peppery, and a dressing made with rice vinegar and a very neutral flavoured oil. And that is that, and it looks very pretty and it's quite poetic. And then to have something as prosaic as, you know, the chicken after that. I like the way that goes.
Well, look, at 14 years old, you were writing down menus in a little book.
Yeah, I was.
So I'm talking to the queen or the king. Or
the nerd. Or
the nerd of menus here. Dan Henry, what a pleasure. Thank you so much, and the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
That was Dana Henry. Her latest book is called How to Eat a Peach. You can subscribe and listen to Mill Street Radio anytime as a podcast. New shows are available every Friday on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, and Spotify. Please subscribe and get all of our shows downloaded right to your phone. Right now, my co-host Sarah Mault and I will be taking some of your calls. Sarah, of course, is the star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on public television, also the author of the book Home Cooking 101. Sarah, how are you?
I'm good, Chris. Let's do this. Hello, welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, my name's Helen Huber from Orcas Island, Washington.
Wow. Helen, how can we help you?
So I bought a can of Amarena cherries, a 2-pound can, and I was using the syrup to make a cherry panna cotta. And then I had all these cherries left over, and I didn't know what to do with them, and I really didn't want to use them for mixed drinks. So I bake a lot, and I thought maybe I can rinse them out since they were so sweet and perhaps try a cherry clafouti. And I did rinse them, and I did drain them, and it was terrible. It was very, very cloyingly sweet. So I wonder if you have any suggestions for things that I can do with Amarena cherries that don't involve mixing drinks.
Well, that was going to be my first. A spritzer was right at the top of my list.
Well, maybe you could mix it into ice cream.
I would mix it into a vanilla ice cream recipe. You could add it as a sweetener to cherry cobbler, or any kind of, even an apple crisp might be nice with that as an addition to it.
Or you know what you could do is combine
it. You mean a small bit of cherries chopped and added to a cobbler? Is that what you mean? I have cherries and I have syrup. I'm just wondering what I can do with the cherries.
Okay, right. Well, when we do an apple galette, for example, a simple apple freeform tart, you could do it any way you want. People add prunes, they add dried cherries. That's one way to do it. So I would use these cherries along with the apples. Apples and cherries really go well together.
But here's another thought. How about combining it with rhubarb, which is notoriously sour? And just adding less sugar to the rhubarb, you know, to the recipe, so that the cherries could sort of carry the rhubarb.
That's a fabulous idea, and I have rhubarb growing, so that's perfect.
Helen, thank you for calling.
Okay,
yeah, take care. This is Mill Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. If you have a cooking question, give us a ring anytime, 855-426-9843. That's 855-426-9843. Or please send us an email at questions@millstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Nina from Cedarville, Arkansas. I was calling about a pancake fiasco that I had a couple weeks ago with my 3-year-old son. He wakes up every Saturday morning demanding pancakes, and usually this is no problem. I use the 100% whole wheat recipe. It works perfectly. Well, this morning we woke up. We were halfway through mixing the batter, and I realized I didn't have any eggs. So there was no time to run to the store. So I thought, well, I'll mash up a banana, maybe that'll work. And then I thought, oh, I've heard of flax eggs where people like mix up ground flax seed and use that instead of eggs. So I had some ground flax seed, so I did that. Well, anyway, it all looked fine. So it went into the pan and then it just stuck completely to the pan.
Did you add anything else to the recipe, or you just substituted ground flax for the eggs?
I read that you're supposed to like mix the ground flax with water and let it soak for a bit.
That is correct.
We're using buttermilk or milk in the pancake recipe?
There would have been milk.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say the culprit was the banana.
That was one thought I had.
I'd say the banana was the culprit because it's so sweet. I mean, especially if it's a very ripe banana, there's all that sugar in there. Was it browner than usual, these pancakes?
Not really. Like the first one, I basically just had to make a scrambled pancake because it just stuck so bad. And then the next one, I thought, well, I'll just put a ton of oil in the pan. Usually I fry in butter, but I was like, I just need one pancake to get this kid so he will be happy. So I put the next one in, and it stuck too, like even in a ton of oil. But I got it cooked enough to like satisfy the three-year-old. And then I saved the batter in the fridge. And later I added an egg, and it cooked up just like a normal pancake.
I doubt the flax. I don't understand why that would stick. It makes no sense to me. Well, I know. Okay, I have an idea.
Okay.
If you had let it sit for a few hours in the fridge and went back, first of all, it was cold. Secondly, it had been fully hydrated. And my guess is the texture of that batter. You know, any pancake batter that sits around for a long time changes texture a lot.
Gets thicker.
Yeah. So I wonder whether it was the time and temperature and it wasn't the egg. I feel good about that answer. Good
yeah.
About it.
Yeah. I like that answer.
Yeah. So it would be just for the heck of it, be fun to make that recipe again, put it in the fridge, and try it a few hours later and see if it
and
sticks.
See it.
Okay. I think that's what it is.
Sounds like a good experiment.
I think that's what it is. I think it's time and temperature.
Yeah. Nina, okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. Good luck.
Thank you, guys.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
You're listening to Milk Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Coming up next, my conversation with Stephen Satterfield, founder of Whetstone Magazine. We'll be right back. This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Today I speak with Stephen Satterfield. Satterfield is the founder of Whetstone, a magazine that explores the anthropology of food. Whetstone avoids celebrity chefs and focuses on real cooks and also the origins of foods, from wine that was invented in the Republic of Georgia 8,000 years ago to authentic Mexican underground barbecue to the origins of the modern banana, a story that, by the way, involves the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire. Stephen, how are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you today?
I'm good. I just want to say congratulations, first of all, on Whetstone Magazine, and secondly, for going into the world of print media when everyone says print media is dead.
So, thank you so much. I really appreciate that, and we're certainly inspired by the trail that you set forth with your many years of creating high-quality print publications.
Well, what I really like about Whetstone is the authenticity. I mean, you really find real people cooking. It's not chefs, you know, so much. It's not all pretty. It's the real deal. And you really get into the culture and the origins in a way I think that is not dressed up for a mass audience. It's real. Let's move on to some of the stories in Whetstone. Michael Twitty, author of The Cooking Gene, he wrote an open letter, you mentioned this in your magazine, to Paula Deen. And it was pretty interesting. First of all, you write, there was also a revelation that many of his friends had dressed up like her for Halloween, which I thought was kind of interesting. But he says, this is a quote from that letter. It says, "You were our sort of soul mama, the white lady with the badonkadonk and the sass and the signifying who gave us a taste of the old country, which is for us, the former Confederacy and just beyond." He basically said, I'm disappointed, but I'm not heartless, and sort of offered her a path to redemption. You know, he didn't really condemn her. He said, look, let's go back and do this right. What did you think about Michael Twitty?
I think that Michael Twitty's success this year as an author and really as a public intellectual on matters of Southern cuisine and culture is timely and a direct result of how smart and sensitive Michael is with this kind of a subject matter. And so what I like about his response to Paula Deen is that he's careful to say that instead of calling her out, he's calling her in.
Right.
Which is, in fact, what we ended up titling the piece.
Let's move to a related topic, which is the much-discussed cultural appropriation. And since you're in the business of going to the roots of culture and food, I think you're a pretty good guy to ask about it. When is cultural appropriation stealing? And when is it just a food like a taco or a burrito or a typical dish from Thailand just becoming part of, you know, world cuisine?
I think what people who are trying to raise awareness around cultural appropriation, let's say, are really trying to do is create a dialogue around power and capital. If you want to host a dinner party to prepare some of the foods that you have perhaps learned on a recent trip to Mexico or even Senegal, then there's no harm there. But when you are using that same knowledge to then open a restaurant, particularly for a population of people that don't have the same freedom of mobility, that don't have the same access, and there's no sharing either in a monetary sense or even just in acknowledgement, then I think that that is problematic, and that is part of what people who have tried to push this discussion towards the mainstream are really alluding to, which is not about who has the right to cook what, but I think that there are some more important implications when it comes to who has the ability to profit off of what was prepared.
Yeah, and I certainly think your point about acknowledgement is crucial. So how do you, food and culture is a changing target. I would argue, I'm not sure there is such a thing as Mexican food. I mean, you know, there was Spanish influence, there was Aztec influence, there's Central American influence. There's even influence down from what is currently the continental United States. I mean, it's a mix of cultures. It's always changing. There really is no such thing as a particular dish that comes from a particular place and time. It's always changing. Is that fair or not?
That particular dish's change over time is certainly true. I think even, you know, I'm from Atlanta, and the way that people talk about barbecue regionally in the right. South is also even a moving target. So I think you find even within like communities or like ethnic communities, you still see some overlap and some shifting in terms of the specificity of the recipes. But I think for us, what we try to focus on is in knowing that there is always a story around tradition and ancestry and food. We really use food as the catalyst to try not to provide definitive answers, but to really go deeper on the questions and explore the questions. And through studying food and the origins of food and anthropology, then we're able to better understand the relationship between the migration of people, of labor, of seeds, and agricultural ideas. And that becomes part of this larger composition of the dishes that we can argue about or just enjoy.
Yeah, preferably enjoy.
Preferably enjoy.
Bananas. You wrote a great piece about bananas. You said Americans consume 30 pounds per year, but Ugandans consume 550 pounds per year.
Yes.
And you said the Cavendish banana, which was one of the great international types, actually started in the majestic Cavendish family garden in England in 1830 and then went back out into the world. It came from Mauritius, went to England, and then went back out to the South Sea Islands. So sometimes the origins of some of our basic foods are pretty complicated.
Exactly. That's a perfect example. And I think the thing that I love about that story is how we got a lot of feedback about that story and really how illuminating it was for particularly Americans to realize just how few varieties of bananas that we see in our country. And the point was illustrated both through the article itself, but also in tandem with working with a designer from San Francisco, an illustrator named Dan Bransfield, who did kind of a cross-section of maybe a couple dozen bananas from all over the world, in which you start to see in a more complete way just how much diversity there is within this single crop.
Yeah, and the things you've never seen in your supermarket, of course, because they don't travel well or they don't ripen properly when they're picked or they bruise too easily, whatever. So American consumers are pretty fickle about the look of their food, right?
Indeed. And, you know, there are some concurrent social movements happening within food and agriculture around ugly produce, I think is mostly how it's being branded or discussed, because there is so much waste at the point of origin. In fact, most of the waste that we see in the food system happens on the farm for exactly the reason that you're describing. So one of the interesting trends that's happening now is that there are nonprofit organizations who are partnering with some of these larger farms to sell the produce that is cosmetically challenged, rebranding it kind of as ugly produce, and then selling that in the same way you might have a local farmer sell a CSA box.
You talked about real barbecue, barbacoa, and you talked about large underground ovens used to slow cook the meat. Could you just describe what that's, how that works and what it's like?
Yeah, this is based on one of our stories from Texcoco, Mexico, which is just north of Mexico City. And Texcoco is a town best known for lamb barbacoa. That is their specialty. And the way that they do it, their tradition of barbecue is really spectacular in that they create and sustain the fire by using maguey leaves. Maguey, a type of agave like you would get tequila or mezcal from. And these leaves are actually essentially smoked and they hold their temperature. And you're able to lower the meat into these really deep pits and also cover with the maguey leaves. So it has this sustained steam and smoke, and it's cooked for a number of hours. I think in total, the whole process is about 18 hours. But the byproduct, of course, it's Mexico. So it's served with an assortment of amazing salsas from local chilies and with tortillas. And you kind of use this very, very tender meat as a medium to put all of the different sauces on. And it's really, really some of the most spectacular barbecue I've ever had in my life.
So in Whetstone, you had a piece about tortillas. Is a really good homemade tortilla just something totally different than what you buy at the supermarket?
It is so much different than what you buy in the supermarket. I mean, I think for people who have had the pleasure of eating homemade bread just out of the oven, you will easily be able to spot the difference in flavor and the experience itself of eating fresh baked bread as opposed to buying a pre-sliced loaf from the grocery store, for instance. And I think it's very much the same experience or comparable when you're talking about fresh-made tortillas versus what you see in the store. But one of the cool things happening in, I guess we should say, the world of corn right now is that there is a growing interest in using corn or making tortillas from corn that is native to Mexico. And so right now, most of the tortillas that we see in the grocery store and tortilla chips, they come from industrial varieties of corn. Hmm. But these native varieties of corn, of which there are hundreds, have really the ability to create a completely new lexicon for chefs all over the world. As we now have people who are exporting these single varieties of corn and making tortillas from that. And each corn, of course, has its own different, you know, flavor profile. And it's one of the most exciting trends that we're seeing, I think, in the country right now.
You know, here's a question for you. I travel a lot. I guess you travel a lot, too. Here's what I've found. I've found you can go to another country where you don't speak their language and vice versa. And you're in a kitchen with someone. And something happens when you start cooking. I was cooking with an 80-year-old mm-hmm. not too long ago, making scallion pancakes, and she was very frustrated. Mm-hmm. I was doing it all wrong. You know, so she started like grabbing the rolling pin out of my hands and telling me I didn't know what I was doing. But we became actually pretty good friends after an hour of this. There's something magical about that. Is that, do you find that when you travel, when you cook with somebody, there's something that happens that it's sort of hard to explain?
Oh, this is absolutely a universal truth that we see over and over again, which is that food is a universal language. It's such a powerful medium, and it's such a powerful means of connecting with other human beings. Except for oxygen, it is probably the most essential part of being a human, and really the only experience that is shared universally. And so what we see over and over again, and certainly what I've seen in my travels, is that once people understand that you have a genuine interest, appreciation, and affinity for the food that they're preparing, they're much more willing to break down walls and barriers to welcome you into their homes.
Do you have a specific example of that?
Well, last year, I traveled to the Republic of Georgia, and along our journey, we were advised about a bed and breakfast, which was in a village called Pankisi Gorge. And Pankisi Gorge is best known of late for being a breeding ground for young teenage boys being recruited into ISIS. And we met this woman, Layla, who owns a bed and breakfast there, who has a really unbelievable and powerful story where her two sons she sent to Europe to try to evade the influence of ISIS, recruiting her sons. And really kind of gut-wrenchingly, she loses her two sons to ISIS anyway, and they end up dying in war. And so Layla decides, as a way to help shift the reputation of this village, that she will open a bed and breakfast in Pankisi where she cooks their traditional food and welcomes visitors in from the outside. There was this reality outside of the gates of Layla's garden in which we were seen as infidels. And because Layla had created so much goodwill in the community and had gone through so much, her guests were basically given a secret hall pass, or there was some measure of understanding. But when you see or read about ISIS in the news, I mean, there's so much confusion and gravity that goes along with that. And that was just a moment where, you know, we came to this village to learn about this woman and to share a meal with her. And it brought us into an environment that we could have never, ever conceived, and around stories that are much more complex than just how to properly make a noodle or a sauce or something like that. And so that's really where I'm the most grateful in traveling, is when we're able to find these moments of connection that in fact end up deepening our empathy for other human beings.
That was Stephen Satterfield, founder of Whetstone Magazine. For 150 years, we've looked to technology to save the world. But what about cooking? With technology, you can stream movies, but with cooking, you can meet your neighbors, feed your family, and enhance your worldview. A Taste of Real Mexican Barbacoa, for example, puts the pulled pork sandwich at your local barbecue joint into perspective. You can cook food, eat it, talk about it, preserve it, and even research it. That's a lot more than can be said of the World Wide Web. Right now, I'm heading into the kitchen at Milk Street to chat with Lynn Clark about this week's recipe, tacos al pastor. Lynn, how are you?
I'm great, Chris.
Well, since I'm the resident historian here at Milk Street, tacos al pastor, we think, comes from Mexico. Actually, really comes from Lebanon, because a lot of Lebanese emigrated to Mexico. They brought the shawarma, which is spit-roasted meat, thinly sliced, but they made a taco out of it with some grilled pineapple, hence tacos al pastor. Now, you were just in Mexico, as you just reminded me, five times, and you had them on the streets of Mexico, right?
I did. I think I probably ate my weight in tacos al pastor. And one of the things I love about it is this balance between the heat from the chilies and the sweetness from the pineapple. It's usually a pineapple salsa, sometimes just slices of pineapple grilled and added to the taco. It's usually slow-roasted pork shoulder done on a vertical spit. Obviously, we weren't going to probably do that at home, on a vertical spit. I don't have a vertical spit. I'm not sure if you do. So we wanted to modify it for a home cook and also make it a little bit quicker. The first thing we're going to do is use the grill. It's a great way to get a lot of flavor really fast. And instead of using pork shoulder, we're going to use pork tenderloin. So that's a leaner, quicker cooking meat. So we can probably do this quickly enough so I could eat tacos al pastor every night of the week.
As you probably have been doing since you got back. So it's pork tenderloin, and how do you cut it?
It's really important here to take the tenderloins and pound them down in between two pieces of plastic wrap to about a half an inch thickness. This is going to create a larger surface area. That's going to help us flavor the meat both with a marinade and on the grill. So there's more surface area.
Okay.
And then we're going to make a marinade here using some of that pineapple that we usually use at the end. We can actually put it into a marinade to flavor the meat. So that's pineapple, cumin, ancho chili powder, and chipotle chilies and adobo. Those get pureed together in a blender or food processor. And then you take some of that to marinate the meat, and some of it is going to be put aside for later. We're actually going to put the meat back into that puree after we cook it.
So cook it on the grill. We take the pineapple on the grill as well?
We do.
Okay.
So first we're going to cook the pineapple on the grill, chop that up. It's going to get some really nice char. Chop it up, add some lime juice, some cilantro and salt, and that's sort of a quick, simple salsa. And then the meat gets cooked about 3 minutes per side. And like I said, we have that nice surface area of the meat, so a lot of that is going to get char on it. And then take it off the heat and cut it into strips. Then it goes back in that puree that we made earlier, right into some corn tortillas, add some salsa. You can add chopped onion on it, shredded red cabbage, lime juice.
So does this mean I don't have to go to Mexico? Or?
I mean, I still advise going to Mexico.
Lots of the 25 other reasons to go to Mexico. So this is about an hour or so?
Yeah, maximum.
So an hour, backyard grill, tacos al pastor, which is grilled pork tenderloin and grilled pineapple. Thank you, Lynn.
You're welcome, Chris. You can get this recipe at 177milkstreet.com.
I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Coming up, Dan Pashman of The Sporkful debates the moral quandary of ice cream shop samples. We'll be right back. This is Milk Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Now it's time to take some calls with my learned co-host, Sarah Moulton.
You're so nice. Yes, I'm ready.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Amelia Ackerman. I'm a fourth grader.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Rochester, New York.
Oh.
Have we ever had a fourth grader call before?
I don't think so.
This is fantastic, yeah. Amelia. Good for you.
Do you listen to, have to ask, do you listen to the show?
Sometimes, yeah, on the radio.
Okay, good. So how can we help you?
So my question is, sometimes my mom cooks with coconut sugar instead of regular sugar, and I was wondering what is the difference between coconut sugar and regular sugar?
Well, coconut sugar is made from coconut sap, and so it's got a nice flavor to it. A lot of people think it's a richer flavor. I'm not sure, maybe Sarah knows. I think it's about equal to white sugar in terms of sweetness.
I don't know about that answer. I do know it has some trace, you know, minerals and stuff in it and things that are good for you, but you'd have to eat an awful lot of it to benefit from those items. It's got, you know, like potassium and calcium.
But I mean, if
stuff.
You want to substitute out, I think it's probably similar. I mean, it's a good question because it's so interesting. We, since about 1880, the United States got really keen on sugar. It became less expensive. It was refined. And all of a sudden, the sugar in our diets went way up. But white sugar has no flavor, which sometimes is a good thing if you want to have other flavors come through. But there are all sorts of other kinds of sugars out there, unrefined sugars, cane sugar, for example, you know, palm sugar, et cetera. So I think they're great. I use them in my coffee. I use them in baking. Very often, you can substitute one for one like coconut sugar. So if you want to add a particular flavor, I think it's a great idea. I mean, it would make a great white cake, for example, I think.
Right. But, Amelia, I have to ask you a question. Have you ever asked your mother why she uses it?
I don't believe I have, no.
Because I'd be fascinated.
Yeah. I believe she uses it either for, like, a health benefit or something like that. A health benefit probably instead of the regular sugar. Yeah.
Does she generally cook healthy food?
Yeah. Like, we don't have, like, Doritos or something.
Well, that's good.
Like, well, that's good.
I approve that. I'm sure you have no soda in your house either.
Yeah.
That's
no.
good. because there's a lot of hidden sugar in there. But I would say, in general, coconut does have some, as I said, you know, minerals and things that are good for you in it. But you'd have to eat a ton of it, and that would not be a good thing. Because at the end of the day, it's a sweetener, like sugar is, and, you know, calorie-wise, and what it does to your body is, you know, basically
Well, sugar is, the unfortunately,
same.
Sugar.
Yeah.
Anyway, for flavor, though, I think
flavor, we approve. Yeah.
Amelia, love having you on the show.
Yes.
Call anytime you want.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. You too. Bye.
Yeah. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Please give us a call anytime with your questions at 855-426-9843. One more time, 855-426-9843. Or please send us an email at questions@milkstreetradio.com.
Hello. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is William from Denver, Colorado.
Hi, William. How can we help you today?
So I inherited a bunch of cast iron pans from my grandmother, and I've been using them for years. And then I had a friend stay with me for a couple of days, and he was trying to thank me by reseasoning one of them that needed it. And it cracked in the middle into four wedges, and we have no idea what happened.
Okay, I have a question. When you're heating it up, is this on full blast? And how long was it sitting on the stove?
It was on the stove about 3 to 5 minutes, and it was on medium.
No. Okay, and then you let it cool on the stove?
Yes.
When did it crack?
It cracked when it started to cool, and then the next time it heated up, it just completely cracked.
No. Is this a cast iron skillet, like a 10 or 12-inch skillet?
Oh, yeah. I've been using it for years.
No, there was... Something happened before then, because 2 to 3 minutes on medium heat's not going to do anything to a 10 or 12-inch cast iron skillet. I mean, just not possible.
It must have had a little crack in it
anyway. Well, something happened. Somebody dropped it. It was really hot and got put in cold water or something.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it sounds like thermal shock from a prior experience, because you just said it needed to be seasoned. Why did it need to be seasoned?
Good question.
Somebody must have not treated it properly the time before, and maybe it did get thermal shock. You know, that's from when it goes from being very, very hot on top of the stove, and then you put it in the sink and put cold water in it.
That's not a good idea.
Not a good thing to do. So it might have already had a tiny hairline crack from that experience. And then when you heated it again, that was the end of it.
Well, it's sort of like a couple Thanksgivings ago, my brother-in-law, I got up the next morning and I noticed my cast iron pan was sitting in the rack, the dish rack.
Uh-oh. Dun, dun, dun.
And I said, what happened? He said, well, he's very proud. He said, I cleaned your cast iron pan for you.
Oh, dear,
and I said,
I
said, you need to leave the house now.
That's exactly what happened to me.
So I wonder if you had a guest who was trying to do a good deed.
That's exactly what happened. He had cooked some pork chops, and I don't eat pork, so he was trying to be nice. So,
Yeah, there you go. When I grew up in Vermont, they used to keep the cast iron pan on the stove. They never, ever cleaned it.
Wow.
Just had a little layer of grease at the bottom.
Whoa. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I mean, it was nonstick.
Yeah.
So I think there was somebody did something.
Yeah. I think it was somebody else who was doing you a favor earlier, because that's why it needed to be seasoned.
Yeah, somebody that didn't fess up to it.
Yeah, I think so.
They put a hot pan in a cold sink.
That's what I think.
What happened.
Yeah.
So anyways, it wasn't you.
Yeah.
So. Well, mystery solved.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. Thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah, pleasure.
Bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Right now it's time for this week's Milk Street Basic. Lapsang Souchong is a widely available very smoky black tea, but it can also add flavor to a simple salt without the usual spiciness of smoky seasonings like chipotle chilies. Here's how to do it. Use your fingers or a spice grinder to blend 1 tablespoon of whole leaf tea into 2 tablespoons of kosher salt. Now use this to season meats or poultry before cooking, or as a finishing salt for vegetables. What do you owe an ice cream shop when you take a sample or 2 or 5? Dan Pashman of The Sporkful is here to discuss that moral dilemma. Dan, how are you?
All right, Chris, how are you doing?
What's going on in your world today?
Well, my world is, I'm embroiled in an internal debate that I'm hoping you can help me with. It's an ethical quandary.
I'm very good at those.
No, I know that you're a man of morals, you're a deep thinker, and that's why I've come to you with this issue, which is, you go into an ice cream shop, and it's common to get samples. You can ask to taste a flavor. They even have those little miniature spoons.
Right.
And maybe you taste one and it doesn't taste as good as you hoped. So you try a second one. You try a third one. Nothing's really doing it for you. What if you turn around after having eaten those three or even four or five samples and walk out and buy nothing? Are you a bad person? Did you do something wrong? Or is that fair game in the world of free ice cream samples?
Well, the question I have to ask you, is this a moral question or is this simply a transactional question?
Well, I don't know that I would separate the two. Part of the morality here is that you are taking something of value from somebody else that if you were to get more of it, you would pay for. So really, is it wrong to accept those samples without paying for them? And there's two fronts. There's the worker who scooped the ice cream for you and who put in effort to get you your samples. And then there's the business owner, which may or may not be the same person, who has paid for that 5-gallon tub of ice cream that you're now taking from.
Well,
so do you owe the business owner something? Do you owe the worker something?
Yes, you do. And here's why. My wife, her rule is because of the service, you are required to buy something. And at first I went like, I don't think so. But she said, that's how it works. That they're helping you and they've invested their time and they expect something in return. So I would say even though a few dabs of ice cream on a little tiny wooden paddle is not a much of an investment on their part, I think morally you are required to buy something. Now, what I would do is buy the tiniest scoop in a cup, and if you really didn't like it, just throw it out when you leave the store. But I do think there's an expectation if you've taken a free sample, other than a piece of bad cheddar in a supermarket. Yeah, I think you owe them something. Yes.
Don't you feel like free samples are built into the cost of running an ice cream store? I mean, that's a very small. Like a 5-gallon tub of ice cream wholesale isn't that expensive, and you're getting one teeny tiny microscopic fraction of that. Isn't that part of the sort of the marketing budget of the ice cream store?
Ah, that's why I asked you whether this was a transactional issue, a monetary issue, or moral. Right, from a financial point of view, they're investing a few cents to make a couple bucks on your ice cream. I don't think it's about the money. I think it's about the person who gave you the flavors, the samples. I think you've established a relationship with that person, no matter how tenuous and short, and you have to fulfill your part of the relationship. It's about relationships.
Chris, I think this is the most emotional I've ever heard you.
Well, I used to drive a taxi in New York when my college years, and I have
really
I tip taxi drivers really well as a result, and restaurant workers, because I do have a deep appreciation for people who do really hard work. And I think scooping ice cream is probably, right there as something that's a difficult job. So I think it's just to say thank you to the person who gave you the samples. It's not about money. It's about you're giving back to that person who gave you something and took their time. It's about time. It's not about money.
What did you learn from being a taxi driver?
We don't have enough time to go into all of that. you know what I learned? I learned that a lot of people do really hard jobs and that a good tip, a nice tip, makes all the difference. It makes your day. So if someone came in my cab, and this is back in the 70s, and it was $10 or $15 on the meter, which would be quite large, if someone threw me $5 as a tip, I'd really feel good. And so a small investment for someone who has a tough job is really worth doing, because you're talking in this case about $2 or $3. It's money well spent.
So what if, getting back to our ice cream store situation, what if you were to just, rather than buy any ice cream, let's say you tried a few samples, decided you didn't like anything, what if you were to just put $1 or $2 in the tip jar, which is typically going to be less money than buying ice cream, and also that money is more likely to go directly to that worker who served you?
That's fine. You are no longer morally culpable.
If the person serving you is nice, because there are times that I feel like when you ask for a couple of different free samples, there are certain people behind the counter who will give you an attitude about it.
Well, that's true.
And if you're going to give me an attitude, that and if the ice cream doesn't taste good, then I'm going to leave.
I agree.
If the person is very nice and friendly and providing good service, and I just don't like the ice cream, then I would put $1 or $2.
Yeah, if it's bad service, you don't owe them anything. But good service, they deserve a good tip. And you know what?
Okay.
Tips are short money, and it makes you feel good, it makes them feel good. I think it's worth a couple of bucks to do that.
All right. I agree with that, Chris.
God, we actually agree.
I know. That's weird.
Well, Dan Pashman, thank you very much. Oddly enough, this week, you and I agree, and we've taken the morally high ground. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
That was Dan Pashman of the Sporkful podcast. You know, Dan Pashman worries about the moral quandary presented by free ice cream samples. Does good service demand a reward? I say it does, but for pretty much selfish reasons. Buying a 3-scoop ice cream cone or generously tipping a wait person is less about them and really more about you. Think of it as tithing, giving 10% of your earnings to a good cause. You are, in effect, paying your debt to the universe for having a good life, one where you can afford a taxi, a nice dinner, even a 3-scoop cone. It's money well spent. That's it for this week's show. If you tuned in too late, you can listen to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts. Remember to subscribe to the show. You'll automatically get every single show downloaded to your phone or tablet each week. If you want to learn more about Milk Street, please head to 177milkstreet.com. You can download each week's recipe, subscribe to our magazine, watch our TV show, or order our new cookbook. We'll be back next week, and thanks for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with WGBH. Executive producer Melissa Baldino. Senior audio editor Melissa Allison. Producer Annie Sinzabaugh. Production assistant Jackie Nowak and production help from Debbie Paddock. Senior audio engineer Douglas Sugarts. Additional editing from Vicky Merrick and Sydney Lewis and audio mixing from Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Theme music by Tubob Crew. Additional music by George Brendel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.